last two Sundays in a church in San Francisco, and the Americans cannot sing quite like the Welsh, I can tell you that. This morning we looked at the washing of the feet of the disciples, and what that told us about Jesus and what it means for us. And tonight we look at the next part of this chapter, and it's a passage of contrasts. We need to remember that John's gospel is different to the other three gospels in the New Testament. You have Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and then you have John. And some people have compared the gospel of Mark, the one that was written first, to a police report. Mark was like someone who is the first person there at the scene. It's quick and it's sharp and it's to the point. It doesn't dwell on any detail for too long. The important things are the facts. And the Gospels of Matthew and Luke, they both use Mark's Gospel as a starting point. So although there are unique moments to those three Gospels, there are stories and ideas that you will find across the board. John's Gospel, however, was written later. And it isn't so much about getting the details out quickly. The people that were reading these words already had the other three Gospels for that. And John says himself that these words are written so that people might believe. And therefore, John's account reads differently. It is far more strategic in how it's been put together. It's symbolic. And it's about helping us understand who Jesus truly was. And John's uniqueness, the book of John's uniqueness, was recognized even in the early church. By the year 200 AD, John's gospel was called the spiritual gospel, precisely because it told the story of Jesus in a symbolic way, in a way that differed sharply from the other three gospels. And we have one of those symbols at work in our chapter this evening. It's light and it's dark. Light and dark. That is a theme that is interwoven throughout the whole book, and it's present in this chapter. John uses the word light 22 times in his book, and the word dark or darkness another 9 or 10 times. And what I want us to consider tonight is the difference between the darkness and light found in the book of John and how it manifests itself, particularly in this chapter. And in turn, I want to ask you, where are you drawn to? Where do you remain? Do you love the light or do you run to the darkness whenever you can? So firstly, I want to look at the light. The whole book of John, if you want to look at John chapter 1, and the first five verses, it begins like this. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him nothing was made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men, and the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. What we have here is the introduction of this idea of Jesus as the light. The image John is trying to capture at the beginning of this book is the same as Genesis 1, the beginning of the Bible, where God said, "Let there be light," in the darkness of nothingness. But here we have these opening verses of John's Gospel, and the darkness is no longer nothingness, but a reference to the dark world which Jesus stepped into. God's people had broken their covenant with God. This was the darkness that Jesus stepped into. It was no longer about loving God, a relationship with God, but it was about rule-keeping, and not even rules that God had given them. Jesus stepped into a world of Pharisees and people who wanted to do good rather than rely on Jesus. But what does the world make of the light? What does the world make of the light? Well, verse 4 of chapter 1 says, the darkness did not comprehend it. Jesus didn't come into a receptive world that celebrated his arrival. From there being no room at the inn, where when Jesus was in the womb, to Herod's attempt to kill him, to being laughed and mocked and ridiculed, to the time where he was, someone tried to pick him up and throw him off the side of a cliff, to his death. Jesus was hated and was rejected by the majority of people. The world was confused by the light. In the same way as a teenager is confused and is angry by the light when it floods his room and his mother comes and opens the curtain on a Monday morning. When Jesus, the light of the world, came into the world, the people were angry. It exposed them for who they were. It exposed their sin. They did not like what they saw because it showed them who they truly were. But Jesus does more than just provide light. He is light. And there are three occasions where Jesus, in the book of John, calls himself the light of the world. In chapter 12 is the famous one. Jesus cries out and says, "He who believes in me does not believe in me, but in him who sent me. He who sees me sees the one who sent me. I have come as light into the world so that everyone who believes in me will not remain in darkness." Jesus is light. Why light? Why does John love picking up on this idea? Well, there's a good reason for it. Because when Jesus says he's the light of the world, there are so many parallels that we can make between Jesus and light. They both dispel fear, for example. Light makes us feel safe, doesn't it? I grew up in London, in the Ends, as they call it. If you want to get to my house, from the nearest tube station, there's a long way and a short way. And the long way involves going up a hill, going down a street, and then another street, and another street. It takes about 20, 25 minutes. There's a shorter way, which takes at least half the time. It takes about 10 minutes. But you have to walk through a park and then an alleyway, and it doesn't feel very safe. Why? Well, because one has streetlights and the other doesn't. You didn't know what was lurking in the shadows while you were walking home at night. The streetlights that were there dispelled any fear that was there. You knew what was there. And in the same way, Jesus dispels fear in our lives. We know that wherever we go, whatever we do in life, there is the security of knowing that Jesus goes with us. Light also shows us the way, doesn't it? Jesus not only goes with us, but he shows the way. And light does this, doesn't it? When you take off on a plane at night, there are lights, aren't there? There are strips of light on the side of the runway to show the pilot where to go. If they weren't there, then he wouldn't have a clue where to go. And Jesus is the same. He shows us the way to go. He's been through everything that we could possibly go through. In living life as a human. And he did it perfectly. And so we in turn know exactly how things ought to be. Even in death, Jesus has gone before us and shown us that death is not the end for us if we're Christians. Light also gives joy, doesn't it? There's some towns in Alaska where in winter they have 2 months without sunlight. They have 2 months without sunlight. And according to research, as many as a quarter of the people that live in towns where this happens suffer from depression. And it's mainly caused by this lack of sunlight. Seasonal affective disorder. You might have heard of it. SAD, it's called. And your body needs sunlight to produce important chemicals like serotonin. Light is needed for joy and for happiness. In hospitals, research shows that patients whose beds are on a sunny side of a hospital experience less pain, and they recover quicker, and it reduces pain in the long term. They use fewer painkillers, and they feel less stressed. We need light in order to help us and to feel better. And in the same way, a life with Jesus, the light of the world, is a happier life. A life with Jesus is a less stressed life. A life with Jesus has less pain. Not that Christians will never suffer or will never feel sad or ever feel pain, but knowing Jesus soothes us, doesn't it? And gives our life meaning and purpose. Why? Well, because, again, we have the hope of the resurrection. Through Jesus' perfect life, death and resurrection, we know that there is more. You see then why John is so keen to emphasize this idea of Jesus as the light. It's a symbol with so many aspects to it. But as well as the light, the beautiful light which Jesus offers, we have the darkness. We know what Jesus, that Jesus shines, but what does he shine into? Well, he shines into darkness. Jesus came into a dark world. A world full of trouble and temptation and betrayal and backstabbing and brokenness. On this very last night before he was killed, where we have already seen this radiant love through the foot washing, we have this backdrop of this darkness. And it reminds me of if you go to a jewelry store and you will notice the diamonds especially, they're laid out on black velvet. And the store does this, doesn't it, to bring out the beauty of the diamond, because the diamond looks even more radiant and shiny against the black. And Jesus' brightness stands out because of the darkness which surrounds him. This night is serious and it's somber, and that adds to the darkness. But the sin around him as well, although it was in God's plan, and although this would lead to Jesus' death, it's very much tangible as you read this passage. And the darkness is never made clearer, I think, than these four words which finish the passage that we closed with just now. And it's in verse 30. And it was night. And it was night. Night is characterized by darkness, isn't it? And night in the first century was truly dark. There were no streetlights. When the sun went down, it was utterly dark. And Jesus has told the room that there was a traitor amongst them. And Jesus tells the disciple whom he loves, John, he says, "It is he to whom I shall give a piece of bread when I have dipped it." And having dipped the bread, he gave it to Judas Iscariot. And in doing this, Jesus is making a reference to the Old Testament. And in Psalm 41, it says this, "All my enemies whisper together against me. They imagine the worst for me, saying, 'A vile disease has afflicted him. He will never get up from the place where he lies.' Even my close friend, someone I trusted, one who shared my bread, has turned against me." Jesus is giving us this insight into who will be the one to betray him. And Jesus, knowing the heart of Judas, says to him, "What you do, do quickly." I'm sure there are many of you sat here tonight who have been betrayed, who have been let down, who have been lied to. And it's a horrible thing, isn't it? It's a horrible and difficult thing to recover from. But Jesus was someone who had loved these friends perfectly and had shared everything with them. And he was now going to have that thrown back in his face. He knew that among those 12 close friends that he had, there was someone who hated him. There was someone who hated him so much that they wanted to see him dead. And so, having received the bread, Judas leaves. And we've spoken about the light that Jesus brings, but what is the very opposite? Well, just as Jesus is light, sin is darkness. Just as Jesus brings security and clarity, darkness brings suffering and confusion, doesn't it? And that's the image that we have as Judas turns his back on Jesus and his disciple, and he leaves the confines of the upper room, and he goes into the night. And in this image of night, we have a picture of Judas's heart. He had eyes that had seen Jesus. He had hands that had touched him. He had a mouth which had spoken to him, ears which had heard him, and yet his heart did not belong to Jesus. It was not the clean heart of someone who had been cleansed and transformed by Jesus. It was a heart that was ruled by selfish ambition, by self-interest. It was governed by sin. It was a heart that was obsessed by all the things that the world loves. All the things that the world says is important. Power, money, and pleasure. And Judas had listened to the lies of the devil. We read in verse 27 that the devil entered into him. The devil entered into him. Which means some people come to this and they think, well, poor Judas never stood a chance. If Satan entered into him, it wasn't his fault. What could he have done about that? But to come to that conclusion overlooks the fact that Judas had opened the door to Satan. His greed and his misunderstanding of who Jesus was meant that he was willing to betray Jesus. He was fully in control. And despite being willing to do what he did it at night because he was ashamed. And it's the same thing that we see time and time again in the New Testament. With anyone who opposed Jesus, they are ashamed by it. In Matthew 21, we're told that the Pharisees looked for a way to arrest him. But they were afraid of the crowd because the people held that he was a prophet. And so they waited. We've been given consciences by God, haven't we? That will let us know right and wrong. When we do something wrong, we know straight away that we've done it. And Judas clearly felt ashamed of what he was doing. Not only did he do everything by the cover of darkness, but after what happened, he threw the blood money, the money that he'd been paid to do this, back into the temple, and he took his own life, didn't he? The darkness seems appealing at the time. It seems like the right thing to do, but it never ends well in the darkness. It will always be night when we turn our backs on Jesus. You see, the darkness which Judas stepped into speaks of his spiritual condition. Because just as Jesus is light, and being in Jesus and trusting in him is to live in the light, to be outside of Christ is to be in the darkness. It's a world of confusion without Jesus. It's a world of shame and deceit without Jesus. Whenever we hear about the darkness in the book of John, it's always equated with evil and confusion and being lost. In John 3, it says this, and this is the condemnation, that the light has come into the world, and men loved darkness rather than light because their deeds were evil. For everyone practicing evil hates the light and does not come to the light, lest his deeds should be exposed. But he who does the truth comes to the light, that his deeds may clearly be seen that they have been done in God. You see, we're all born hating the light. Because light exposes our shortcomings and our failures. If you've ever been to a concert and you've been dancing maybe, and suddenly the lights come on and you feel a lot more stupid when that happens. The light exposes our failures. Some people believe that babies are born good and innocent. Maybe not many people, but some people do. And they only learn how to be cruel and selfish from spending time with other people. But we know that this is not the case, isn't it? We're born with darkness in our hearts. We're born with what the Bible calls sin in our hearts, a thing that separates us from God. And people are the opposite to plants in many ways, but in this way in particular. Plants needing light to survive always grow bending towards the light. That's GCSE biology for you. This is to ensure that they get everything that they need in order to grow. We're the opposite, however, aren't we? We are drawn to darkness. Everything that we do is drawn to what makes us happy and what brings us pleasure. We're like cockroaches in a way, who run into the corner of a room when the lights come on. We are selfish and we're angry and we're rude and we're prone to lying. And we stay away from light because it exposes who we are. Now we can see Judas as different to us. We can see him as a step beyond us, maybe. And we don't know much about Judas. We know that he was one of the 12 disciples. We know he was responsible for looking after the money. And in films, we're helped, aren't we? Because the bad guys always look like bad guys. They always have some distinguishing feature which lets you know right at the beginning of the film that they are that type of person. They have a scar across their face, or a hook for a hand, or a twirly moustache as they kind of that they play with when they're thinking of evil plans. But Judas looked like the disciples. He talked like them and he acted like them. Because when Jesus tells the room that there was a traitor among them, the disciples had no clue. They don't all suddenly think, ah, that'll be Judas. In the Gospel of Matthew, we're told, it says that the disciples all said, is it me? They suspected themselves before they suspected Judas. And the fact that Judas was in charge of the money probably indicates that he was the most trusted of them all. And yet, as Jesus gives him this piece of bread, it becomes clear that he is the traitor. Different books, different films have explored the life of Jesus. They've often got different theories as to why Judas did what he did. You hear that word so often in detective dramas, motive. What was Judas's motive? In some things that you see, it's a dissatisfaction with who Jesus was and wanting someone that would defeat the Romans. One film shows it to be a jealousy trait or a love triangle even, which is just ridiculous. We don't know what exactly made Judas do what he did. We know that his attitude towards money was a factor, and yet it comes down to this fact. Jesus rejected who Jesus was. The compassionate, selfless Jesus didn't appeal to Judas. Judas didn't love Jesus. And it breaks our hearts as we read verse 21. When Jesus had said these things, he was troubled in spirit. Jesus, who was perfectly patient, perfectly good and perfectly loving, is here, troubled in spirit. And when he thinks of this betrayer among them, it troubles him. And he had known it for a long time. In John 6, he says, have I not chosen you the 12? Yet one of you is a devil. He had had this truth at the back of his mind for such a long time. But as this moment of true betrayal comes closer and closer, as the cross looms large, it suddenly gets too much to bear. And Jesus does something about it. He has to do something about it. And he dismisses Judas. Leave. Do what it is you have to do. And when Judas came to the chief priests and the leaders of the religious officials, he asked them how much money they would be willing to give. And he was given 30 pieces of silver. And someone pointed out that this was the exact same amount of money that someone in the ancient Middle East would have been given if someone had accidentally killed their slave. Jesus had failed to measure up as a slave to Judas's desires and agenda. And so Judas conspires to get him killed. If you're sat here this evening and you're skeptical, you've never thought that Christianity is for you. Maybe you've come along to church Maybe your family forces you to come along. Maybe you think to yourself, if only I had seen Jesus for myself. If only I would have heard Jesus speak. Yes, hearing someone talk about something doesn't compare to the experience of seeing something for yourself. So you think, if only I'd have seen one of his miracles. If only I would have seen the love that he shared. If only I would have heard one of his amazing sermons. If I would have experienced that firsthand, then I would be a Christian. I would be the most dedicated one of all those Christians. Yet Judas was not just someone who saw Jesus with his own eyes. He was someone who experienced Jesus with a backstage pass. He ate with him. He heard him as he spoke in private. Only 11 other people in existence had this same privilege. And yet, being this close to Jesus wasn't enough. Seeing Jesus face to face, listening to him every day, wasn't enough to save Judas. Let that challenge you this evening. Judas's story also contains an important lesson for us on the other side. If we're grieving over someone who we know and love, who has abandoned the faith, who has walked away from it all, we may feel responsible, or we might feel like we could have done something more. There are things, yes, that we can do that encourage people to become believers, but we are not responsible for other people's salvation. One preacher put it like this: with Judas's own eyes, he saw the clearest evidence. With his own ears, he heard the best teaching in the world. With his own feet, he followed the greatest example. And yet this man still betrayed Jesus. And so, know this evening that you cannot lead someone to Jesus yourself. And so Judas can remain this figure in our minds who we look at with disdain and such disbelief that we can often forget that he very much looked like the real thing. He looked like the best Christian around. Judas was in the inner circle. He was a fine preacher of the gospel, but there was a double-mindedness about him. And in the end, he abandoned the faith he once professed. And it's a sobering reminder, isn't it, that a person's heart can be different to the outward appearance. Here we have someone who looked the real deal. In today's terms, he would be someone with a best-selling book, someone that had just won Premier Christian Radio's Best Christian Twitter Account of the Year. They would have spoken at conferences, and they would have thousands of subscribers to their podcast. This was someone who preached, who healed people, who was one of Jesus' closest friends. Yet it's a reminder that if we don't love Jesus, and if we don't see him for who he truly is, then we will remain in darkness. Closeness to Jesus doesn't save you. So let me remind you, your church attendance doesn't save you. Helping out at church things doesn't save you. Giving to charity doesn't save you. Telling people about where you've been on a Sunday and telling people about your faith doesn't save you. Because all of these things suggest that you have something to offer. We need to rely on Jesus completely. We don't have anything to give in this situation. There is a part of Judas in all of us. We're all prone to doing the same. We're all prone to put ourselves first. The question isn't whether we have betrayed Jesus, it's the fact that we all have. The question is whether we have repented, whether we have been cleansed, as we were thinking about this morning. Have we been washed clean? In Colossians, Paul describes being saved as being delivered from the domain of darkness and being transferred to the kingdom of his beloved Son. So let me ask you tonight, have you been delivered? Are you still in the domain of darkness? Have you put your trust in Jesus, the light of the world tonight? Or tonight, when this service finishes, will you walk away from Jesus and into the night? Like like Judas did. It's a serious thought for you. There is no half-light where you're good with the world and good with Jesus. Let me just encourage you with these final words. As Jesus saw the night, as he saw Judas's back, he knew that in a few hours' time there would be darkness like the world had never seen before. And whereas before he had seen the back of someone who hated him, on the cross, God turned his back on Jesus. Christ, the one true light, endured complete darkness for our sake on the cross. And as we saw this morning, know that Jesus was willing to wash the feet of those disciples and will lovingly serve you. But also know that Jesus, who is the light of the world, was willing to endure the deepest darkness on our behalf as he died the most horrible, painful death. Don't stay in the darkness. Will you come to the light tonight? Let's pray. Oh Lord, Heavenly Father, help us. We need your help. I pray for anyone in this room who's been challenged, who has been thinking these things through, Lord. Help them to know that there's nothing that they can do. There's nothing we can do as people, Lord. We must just rely on you and admit that we're helpless without you, Lord. We thank you that you have made a way. You've made a way that means